Welcome back to the Devil's Advocates Radio Show. We have at it Friday edition, Dom, and we're going to have at it with a fine guest, a friend of ours. He joins us right now. He's the birthday boy, former U.S. Attorney James Santel. Jim, welcome back. Just a year older.
Happy birthday, Jim.
Good to be with you today. I got to bring chocolate chip cookies to the class treat and got to specially decorate my locker today. So it's truly a throwback.
That's excellent, Jim. I won't even ask how old you are, but let me ask you, sort of off topic, before we really get into the meat of the interview. Jim, if you were going to fight a public figure for, let's say, a celebrity boxing event, who would that be? And do you think you'd be fighting up a couple of weight classes against Bill Barr?
I think I probably would be under any circumstance. Yes, absolutely. And I'll have to pull down my list of potential opponents and get back to you on that.
Locally, any locals like to take a swing at? Because I got a few.
go ahead, and then I'll check them off the box, my boxes here as we.
I've put a challenge out, and I'm being entirely sincere when I say this. Dan O'Donnell, I want a piece of your ass, man. Let's go, Dan. I can take you. I'll whoop your ass. Let's meet in the ring. Let's, you know, raise a few bucks for charity.
You know, to make this academic, which it always is when we get together, trial by combat, right? We're going back to fundamental notions about how we administer justice. And so it may not be a 21st century concept, but there's certainly precedent for it in our long lost history.
Yeah, there is.
Two men enter, one man leaves. James Santel, I've got to ask you, the president, sort of pugnacious in his own regard today, says, have at it, in response to, will they sue me, will Republican governors? And the answer, of course, is yes, they'll sue Joe Biden, the Biden administration. But let's talk about the legality of these vaccine mandates as Joe rolled them out on the air yesterday. Let's start with the executive orders. Got any issues with the president issuing executive orders for the federal workforce? That seems like a no-brainer, does it not, Jim?
It is a no-brainer, none whatsoever. This is an executive authority. This is a presidential authority in many, many ways, many areas. Presidents of both parties, all parties, have often established rules and regulations that bring the federal workforce in line with what the policies and good practices of the government should be. No problem with that whatsoever. And if there is a challenge to it, which again, I suspect there probably will be, anticipate that, well, we hope we would anticipate that there would be no federal judge who would look at that and say, listen, a president can't even establish regulations for the operation of federal employees. A no-brainer, I agree.
Well, and contractors that would interact with the federal government, they would fall under a similar umbrella, Jim?
Same kind of umbrella, same kind of thing. If you decide that you want to contract with the government, that's a decision you make voluntarily. You don't have to do that. But once you do that, there are all kinds of things appropriately upheld by the courts inside of contracts that I have, you have, corporations have to perform services, to provide products to agencies of the government, to otherwise support federal functions. If I do that, I have to agree that I will abide by the rules and regulations that the government establishes. It's a contract arrangement. And again, no problem with those either.
So, Jim, let's talk about the quote-unquote mandates of private businesses of 100 or more employees. Let's start with the fact that he set a number that comes off as arbitrary, or perhaps arbitrary and capricious, as my sparring partner Dan O'Donnell might say. Well, you got to pick a number, right, Jim? Is there anything arbitrary and capricious about picking a number of 100 employees?
And nothing arbitrary and capricious at all. Again, not only because I support what the president's doing as a practical matter, but recognize once again, there's an awful lot of precedent for this, right? In the employment area, when I heard the president was doing this, in the employment area, I thought about Title VII. What does that say? Well, the Americans with Disabilities Act, all kinds of things out there in the employment setting that do not apply to very small businesses. But you have employees of a certain numbers, certain categories, and then they do apply. Why? Because we want to have this greater impact upon the community in which we live. So that notion of selecting a certain threshold number and applying it and ensuring that people, companies, and institutions that employ a certain number, that there's an awful lot of precedent for that. Once again, And the question is your executive order, what you're doing, is it reasonable and rational? Does it meet some legitimate government purpose, some function? And my answer to all that would be yes, yes, and yes, that this is something the president has the authority to do. He's doing it not in a draconian way, not in a capricious way. It's balanced, it's rational. That's what the arguments will be when it gets into court, certainly, and it will, as you indicated, go into court. But this does not strike me as the kind of thing that a president would be turned around on, if you will, by a court. Now, again, executive orders have been the subject of lots and lots of litigation, we know. President Obama in the immigration area, frankly, President Trump as well, lots of things in court. But this one strikes me as, it's the ultimate thing that a government does, right? We want to preserve your health. We want to keep you alive. That's the reason the president is doing what he's doing. That's a very strong governmental function and a very strong justification what he's announced.
Well, Jim, I'll allow Dominic to challenge you on the prior precedent, but let me ask you, all these same whining conservatives and these same whining whitey talk radio hosts, et cetera, they're the same ones that are all down for what's happening in Texas and this heartbeat abortion bill, which, of course, doesn't give women any control over their own bodies. Jim, do you see any contrast here?
Contrast is understating it, right? hypocrisy is a word that's used a lot, and that one applies. Inconsistency, incongruence, basic incapacity to do. It's not left and right brain. Those are two different concepts we're talking about there. But how you approach these issues without any consistency in your basic theories, your basic ways of looking at things, you've identified it just right. If you're going to embrace life, you're going to embrace health, then you need to do that across the board. And the difference, again, the Senate Bill 8 matter in Texas, that, again, lots of focus by the Department of Justice, which I'm sure we'll talk about. Those who would promote that as a way of doing whatever the purpose of that particular bill is, and plainly it is to restrict reproductive rights access, and at the same time maintain that mask mandates and vaccination mandates, which are also intended to protect health and security, that those have to fall. It is irreconcilable. And again, that's a nice way of putting it.
Folks, you're listening to the Devil's Advocates Radio Show. James Santel, birthday boy, our friend, former U.S. attorney joining us. Appreciate it, Jim. Briefly getting back to the number. The ACA, I believe, has a requirement of 50 full-time employees, right? So, I mean, there's all sorts of legislation out there and requirements based on different sizes and different numbers. So I just throw that one out there as well. But with regards to the mandate of vaccines. Now, what I did notice on this, number one, was as it pertains to the private employees, the president just didn't say everyone's got to get a vaccine. What he said was, you either have to get a vaccine or you have to do weekly testing. Now, was that a political out, or do you think that was that he in fact actually has the constitutional authority to require the vaccines, even without the option of weekly testing, because of the Jacobson versus Massachusetts ruling in 1905?
Right. And again, I commend to all of your listeners, I know that the two of you have Jacobson posted on your bulletin boards in your studios. It really is a wonderful articulation, not only of the capacity, the constitutional capacity of the government to impose, to require that citizenry, in this case, in a small town in Massachusetts, be vaccinated against the smallpox scourge at that time. But there's this wonderful language inside of it that in many ways is responsive to your good question, Dom, about how we are parts of a community. And for that reason, we do in fact have to abide by some basic rules, some restrictions on what we might think are our personal liberties, that really don't exist when you are living in a larger group. So I commend that language to all your listeners, and to read through that. It's wonderful, exalting language. As to your specific question, again, my view is yes, the president can mandate, as he has done this. No doubt his legal counsel, folks at the Department of Justice, have scoured through this and written in a way that should stand up in court. But he's also, again, with respect to this sort of alternative testing provision, also said, look at how reasonable I'm being. And I think that's written not only for practical purposes, but also so that when those attorneys for the executive branch get in front of a federal district judge, they can say, listen, not only is the president identifying sizes of groups that are appropriately and fashioned, and we can talk about that, but he's not so draconian as to say you can only do this. You have alternatives, and judges love those kinds of things where you're looking at a government actor who's doing things in the alternative to make certain that everybody's interests are met. You've got a vaccination problem, whether it's a health-related issue, a religious objection of some point. All right, then here's the category we're going to put you in. But all of that ultimately focused upon what? The president's obligation to keep us safe and secure, government's obligation to keep us healthy, and yes, that's right, alive. Nothing could be more important than that.
Jim, that particular case was versus a state, and it gave that state the authority to do that. Does the federal government, because of that case, also automatically have that same authority?
You know, that's the kind of thing that lawyers get rich off of and make arguments about. And I would argue, if you look at the language Justice Harlan wrote, I think it's broad enough to encompass federal authority to do the same kind of thing, especially with, again, it's very lofty language about how we live in this community. Plainly, lawyers would parse that out and say, well, wait a minute, that's focusing upon a state, a federal government. That's, again, how we continue to live our lives as lawyers. But I think the language, the better argument is to say, yes, it's very broad. Again, the other point of it is, obviously, it's 115, 116 years old. But it still is compelling law. It's still on the books. And again, the justification for it, to my mind, applies with equally compelling force today as it did in the early 20th century.
You know, Jim, the contrarian would argue that the very same court that made that ruling in 1905 went on to rule that the government could do forced sterilizations. And it was using this same or similar logic that it was in the public's best interest to sterilize those that shouldn't breed. You know, people like Dom. But anyways, Jim, in that light, is that the fact that we have obviously evolved as a society, or we'd like to think we have, do we also see evolvement of the law? When you talk about turning over precedent, you know, I mean, 1905, I know Roe's perhaps the question of whether that will be overturned, but could you see this court in its current makeup finding justification to overturn this old law?
Absolutely. And again, two observations. One is, it is a fact of historical legal status that the Supreme Court docket is littered with opinions that today we would not only bristle at, but find offensive. Plessy versus Ferguson, Dred Scott, those kinds of cases that we look at today, some of those by majority opinions. And today we think, my goodness, how could any human being embrace those principles? So Supreme Court, like any part of the government, federal government, state government, local government, we would say today makes mistakes, sometimes terrible mistakes. And the question is, again, what does our contemporary view about what America is? What does it tell us about that? Not that the Supreme Court should be completely focused upon polls and what our population says, but we do evolve. Our nation today is wildly different, as we have talked about, than it was 245 years ago. I've often said James Madison would have no idea what was going on right now with the radio and with that we're on Zoom and all these kinds of things. And so life does march on. And so I would maintain the Constitution's living. Laws need to respond to the reality of today. And to get back to your question, is it possible that the same Supreme Court that does make a decision, decides Roe versus Wade in 1973, Planned Parenthood versus Casey in 1992, that talks about access to abortion, could the present Supreme Court go in the opposite direction? Yes. And frankly, I think there's every indication, this is the bad news that comes out of even what the Department of Justice is doing this week, every indication is that our Supreme Court is going to find a way, if not to completely overrule Roe versus Wade, this case versus in Dobbs, but it's going to chip away at it.
Folks, you are listening to the Devil's Advocates Radio Show. We'll come back with our fine guest, former U.S. Attorney James Santel.
Will there be a lawsuit? Yeah, probably.
Have at it.
Why don't you punch me in the face?
Oh!